With me is Time magazine film critic Richard Schickel. Schickel has spent most of his working life writing about films. He's written books about Walt Disney and D.W. Griffith. His book Intimate Strangers, The Culture of Celebrity, analyzed the influence of celebrities on our personal lives. Schickel's new book zooms in on one part of the celebrity-making machine. It's a book of color still photographs produced by Hollywood studios to promote their stars and their movies. It features actors and actresses of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. He's written the introduction and the accompanying text. The book is titled Striking Poses. Richard Schickel, welcome to Fresh Air.
Good to be here.
Can you describe the function of the publicity shots that are in your book?
Yeah, it should be said, first of all, that most of them were not made to specifically publicize a given film. I mean, they were made when people were under contract for 7 years to studios. And they were designed in the same way that, I don't know, cigarette advertising is designed today, to keep people aware of certain brand names and keep them before the public by hook or by crook. In most of these cases, I think the pictures are quite funny because they're outrageous pictures. I mean, there was such competition between the studio stills departments, really, to get ink, get these pictures into the newspapers around the country that were having color supplements in those days, which began in the late 30s, which is really where the book begins, and doesn't really go into the 60s so much. You were slightly wrong in your introduction. There are a few pictures from the 60s and a few from the 30s. The great age of this kind of publicity still was the 40s and the 50s. When, you know, every newspaper had a sort of Sunday screen and radio section, the movie magazines were in full cry, there were lots of not too elegant picture magazines available in the United States in barbershops and so forth. So that's what these pictures are designed to do. And the pictures are, I think, kind of surreal in their quality because the more outrageous the pose, the more so slightly ridiculous in a way, the more it caught your eye, literally, the more newspapers and magazines would pick it up.
Two of the photos that I really enjoyed as contrasts were of Janet Leigh. One is from 1963 when she's in Bye Bye Birdie, and it's like Janet Leigh, the mother shot. And it's, you know, Janet Leigh on the set with her two children. One's on her knee and the other's sitting alongside of her. Then the other shot's from 1965, and it's at the time she's doing Kid Rodeo. There she is wearing this black lace teddy with a black garter belt, black stockings, high heels, with a gun belt strapped around her hips.
Giant six-gun, gun belts and garter belts.
Yeah, and her gun's in her hand, and boy, does she look tough in that. It's such an interesting contrast.
Needless to say that there is no point in that movie in which she wears such a getup.
Yeah, I figured.
It's a straight publicity department composition. There's a third picture of her, too, which is her sort of studio wedding picture with Tony Curtis. And they're kind of, I don't know how to explain it, they're kind of doing a smooch, a big, you know, their lips are sort of bulbously pursed out in order to, and they're looking just adorable and cute, you know, sort of Sandra Dee, early 60s, late 50s, cute. That's the style of that picture. There were all these stylizations that operated, too, in the composition of these pictures. I mean, we have a long section in Striking Poses of just the holiday pictures. You know, I mean, the girl sitting on a pumpkin, the girl with a turkey in the picture, the girl, one of my favorite pictures in the book, the Lane sisters, which only your older listeners will remember, but we're kind of minor movie stars of the late 30s, and they're got up as Christmas presents, and they're sort of seeming to be tucked under this giant Christmas tree. among other things, this is sort of sexist. That's the other thing that I think doing this book was kind of consciousness raising to me, because the pictures you're looking at radically and much more radically objectify the women than the men. I mean, the kind of garter belt.
There's terrific props that are always used.
Lots of faintly salacious, sort of phallic rockets and whatnot when they're posed with them, but also just the sort of cutesy poo-ness of the way they showed women in these pictures. I think they're still funny, but I couldn't help thinking, and I think I may have mentioned it in the introduction, that you know, you cannot, it is some measure of progress, possibly, that you cannot imagine any stars comparable to these today permitting such a picture, such pictures to be taken.
How come the, how come movies and stars aren't publicized with the same kind of stills, posed stills
well, I
that
think
they
for,
used
I
to
think,
use?
Yeah, I think for two reasons. First of all, these stars were under long-term contract to the studio. So as I said at the outset, the studios had an interest in kind of cranking out publicity material to keep people reminded between pictures that whoever, Barbara Stanwyck or Charlton Heston or whoever, was a movie star and was about to be out in some new picture. There was that. But the other thing was that the media changed. I mean, in other words, television, and in particular, I would say the television talk show, in a way replaced all of these magazines. Mostly they replaced the movie magazines. And so there wasn't the same call for them. Most of the magazines that published this kind of thing, and even the newspapers that published this kind of thing, either went out of business or changed radically. I mean, the star today has a different photographic curse, if you will, and that's the paparazzi picture. I mean, in other words, the stars hated, by and large, hated going to down to the stills department to do these pictures. I mean, partly, particularly in the early days, they had to pour a lot of light onto them. The film was quite slow, so it was very hot and boring work and slightly degrading work in many cases. So they hated doing it. I think stars also hate being frozen. I mean, what they're selling is animation, so the moving pictures and still pictures were psychologically quite different things for them to do. But in return for these importunings to come to the studio stills section, they were really greatly protected. I mean, in other words, it was impossible technologically, let's say in the 40s, for a cameraman to sort of lurk outside a restaurant or outside a resort and with his 200-millimeter lens and try and get a picture of somebody half-naked when they didn't want to be shown half-naked. Now, of course, that's become their curse. I mean, in other words, the studios can't protect them because they're all freelancers. I mean, they have no machinery really to protect them. So if they go out shopping or to a restaurant or something, the chance of somebody lurking in the bushes and grabbing a shot are very much higher. So, I mean, you know, one unhappiness has replaced another unhappiness in their lives in terms of the still camera.
Although the movie studios don't have stars under contract to them anymore because there really aren't movie studios in the way there used to be, there's still plenty of movie stars. How are they marketed differently than they used to be under the studios? You alluded to the
typical,
to talk shows, for instance.
Yeah, the typical star today is usually has under fairly long-term contract one of the several large publicity firms that you know deal in movie stars, and for a percentage of the star's income, they will manage this aspect of the star's career. But generally speaking, that means keeping them away from the press unless they have a film coming out, in which point a campaign is orchestrated, which may include magazine articles, some photography for those. I mean, you know, we do a cover story at Time. Likelihood is that we will cause to have created a set of still pictures that the star will cooperate in making, certainly for a cover image. Then they will do a certain amount of, possibly for a high-quality magazine, between pictures may do sit for a profile, but the magazines will want them to key on a film. So their effort is always to a campaign, which may begin some months before a picture is completed, for the picture. They will also do work while the picture is on location, of course. Anyway, they're in the hands of these firms, and they have a great deal more to say with the publicity firm about what they will do and not do than they ever did in the studio days.
Now, I think one of the tricks to modern publicity is that if you're well known and you know that the press wants to talk to you, you only make yourself available when you have something to promote.
I think so. I mean, but of course, There are exceptions. Obviously, there are people who have charities that they're interested in. They have.
But nowadays, it's causes, don't you
causes,
think?
Causes, yeah. No, now that I'm living in Los Angeles, there's an awful lot of charity that, you know, doesn't make the national press. But there's always a dinner or a luncheon or what have you going on out there that, you know, some stars will be recruited for. I mean, and they range, you know, through all the ills of mankind. You can find a star who will help you promote it.
Film critic Richard Schickel is my guest. Do you think celebrities play a different role in American life than they did in, say, the 30s, 40s, or 50s?
Well, I have a feeling that is reflected in Striking Poses, that the celebrity, the movie star in those days, was a much more iconographic figure. And again, the icons, you know, part of the rub that was between them, besides not liking the hot lights in the Stills studio, they were always fighting their sense of who they were and the studio's sense of who they were, which were often in opposition. I mean, in other words, Jean Tierney might think of herself quite logically as a sort of upper crust girl from good schools and a social background in New York. But the studio sort of thought of her, because she had these high cheekbones, as this sort of slow-eyed Eurasian vamp type. So, I mean, the woman in the studio would have been in considerable conflict. I think nowadays there is more emphasis on reality. This is the real person we are now presenting to you, whether in stills or in a magazine interview. There's less of an attempt, because it would be harder to sustain. There's less of an attempt to try and pass someone off as their icon. I mean, in other words, the icon and the reality have to be somewhat more congruent now than they were in the 30s. Because, again, the thing we were talking about before, the protectiveness of the studio. You could insist that Clark Gable was an incredibly sexy male figure, even though there's testimony from his wives that he wasn't so terribly sexy. But you could sustain that image perhaps better in those days. Maybe the tragic case of Rock Hudson would be a good example. I mean, you know, I mean, most people in the business knew that he was homosexual from the 50s onward. But at the time that he was a major motion picture star, I think the general public was, in fact, unaware of his homosexuality. I think it had, you know, obviously tragic effects on his life and on his personality. One might even think that he might not have been so driven in a sort of homosexual cruising, if he had been free to be what he was. But there was an element of, I thought, comes out a little bit in the Sarah Davidson book, of self-destructive rebelliousness in that behavior, which, of course, could have led him to AIDS and all the rest of it. I mean, that part is speculation, but I'm pretty sure about the self-destructive rebelliousness. And that was, of course, true of many stars who either went all the way into, you know, kind of Frances Farmer self-destruction, or got pretty close to it and pulled back from it in previous times, in the sort of Striking Poses times, if you will.
I want to talk with you more about the effect of celebrities on our culture today, but we have to take a short break. My guest is Time Magazine film critic Richard Schickel. We'll be back in just a few seconds. This is Fresh Air. Time Magazine film critic Richard Schickel is my guest. He's written the text for a book of still photos which were produced by Hollywood studios to promote their stars. The book is titled Striking Poses. I want to continue talking about celebrities. John Lennon was probably the first celebrity assassination. Mm-hmm. And even the Ronald Reagan assassination attempt tied in with movies and celebrity.
Distinctly a celebrity attempt at assassination.
Do you think that stars are getting more paranoid about their fans?
I think a lot of stars are not so terribly concerned about themselves, perhaps, but I think they are concerned about their families. There are more and more... there are firms now that specialize in celebrity protection, and much of their work has to do with protecting the families of the stars. I mean, they're concerned about that. But a man who runs one of these firms, who called me up after Intimate Strangers was published, was really scary to talk to, because he did say that so much of his work deals with truly psychopathic writings and mailings, often of a highly obscene nature, to the Stars. He told me that he had stopped several Hinckley-like characters who were on their way to Hollywood and were in the vicinity. I know personally of one such case of a family stalking a Stars family. It was a family of people stalking the Stars family.
Well, do you have any theories about why there's this, I don't know if it's hatred or what, but why fans want to go out and attack Stars?
It's love-hatred, I mean, obviously.
Jealousy, maybe? Or?
Well, I think there's I think jealousy stops short of psychopathic behavior. I think there's a volatility in people's relationships with movie stars. In other words, there's a sort of love mixed with a sort of envy.
And also this feeling, I think, of it. Well, I'm not good enough for you, right?
It can fall over into envy very quickly, the love, especially if the star in some sense miscues. I mean, a case that's kind of interesting to me at the moment, and I don't have any firm conclusions about it, is that of Burt Reynolds, who, you know, was a sort of beloved star a few years ago, and suddenly this man cannot make a picture that's successful. It's as if, I don't know, I've speculated that aging, he's now too old to play the good old boy image that he was playing. I speculate that, you know, maybe his feminist consciousness raises the kind of attitude toward women that he expressed could conceivably have backfired against him at this date. I speculated, you know, the rumors that circulated and which he's had to deny and deny and deny of him having AIDS, which there's no reason to doubt his word on this point. He, you know, was afflicted with a very unpleasant inner ear disease. It's actually quite common. Several of my friends have had it, and it's horrible, and it does cause enormous weight loss. It causes you to look as if you're drunk in public because it affects your balance, all that sort of thing. That may have affected him. I mean, people don't like to think of a star as ill. You know, that illness is supposed to not touch a movie star until great age comes upon them, and then we can mourn their passing with, you know, fatuous television tributes to them. But all of these things have touched him, and this is a career once of enormous magnitude that now is, you know, in what seems to me fairly desperate condition. It's a very volatile relationship. I do think that the relationship of the star to his general public is simply one of these strange, volatile, you know, love, envy things. Now, there is that percentage of the population that is psychopathic, and I suppose I sometimes, in despair, estimate it at 10% of the population. I don't know, maybe it is. It could be 5%. I think it's a substantial percentage in
some cities,
large
it's
country.
Higher than others.
Yeah, and I would say that behavior is not to be compared with ordinary fan behavior. That's really sicko stuff, and you know, the Hinckley thing surfaced a lot of it. But I'm telling you that any that I've ever had become close enough to know anything about with, and that's not very many, but the fact is, you know, they people send them nude photos of themselves endlessly. They send them all kinds of weird things in the mail. It's a real sick thing, and I, in some sense, almost hate to talk about it in public, because you know what? There's always some psycho out there who says, "Well, that's a good idea." So it really is I don't know what to be done about it, but I think more and more stars will protect themselves and should protect themselves. I mean, it'd be crazy not to.
You've written something interesting about journalists who write about celebrities, and you say that journalists are sometimes distrusted and thought of as double agents because they're suspected to be writing about famous people to help themselves become famous. And yeah. since you're in the movie reviewing business, I wonder if you've experienced this kind of distrust firsthand.
No, the distrust that's visited on a movie critic is quite different from the distrust visited on a
A People Magazine type journalist?
They have a word for it out there. Interview press. The interview press. I'm not of the interview press. And deliberately so. I mean, I simply do not do profiles.
Yeah, I guess I am of the interview press.
I guess you are. But, I mean, it's respectable in public broadcasting. And Philadelphia is a nice, safe, pleasant city. No one would think of you as threatening. But I think they do feel threatened by a reporter from a major publication like People. It has a gigantic and not very high level reach. No, I was thinking there of the kind of people like Rex Reed in one of his former incarnations. There's usually always a hot celebrity interviewer around at a different level, Oriana Fallaci. These people, I think, are frightening because, you know what? They are career. They are attempting to build a career. They are saying, oh, no, no. And they'll lie. They'll really will say, no, this is off the record, and then it will get on the record. And I mean, I would say that the standards of the interview press, the movie people see, are the lowest in journalism, which doesn't have the highest of all standards to begin with, as witnessed poor Gary Hart's condition last week. But I think this this fear is real. That's the only place it affects me is sometimes unthinkingly, you know, if I run into someone, a director or a movie actor, and they sort of just say press. I mean, I hate being lumped personally with the press, as they say. I know what they mean by the press. They mean these people who intrude upon them and are not necessarily to be trusted. And it's one of the reasons that I, in a funny way, more and more withdraw from contacts of that kind with people. I know sometimes when I'm producing television shows, obviously I have actors who are hosts and I work with them and I enjoy them, you know, but we are in a different professional relationship there.
You grew up in a Midwest suburb.
Mm-hmm.
And you've written that it was popular culture, the books you read, the movies you saw, radio shows you listened mm-hmm. to, that made you restless and made you want to get out of this
I think that's
suburb
true.
That you are in. Do you think that's why people sometimes fear popular culture, because it will make people restless with the lives that they live?
Oh, sure. There's no question in my mind that the rise of popular culture in the United States is one of the things that, you know, really broke up our urban and small town America that kind of persisted into the 20s. And I would say, I mean, again, I don't want to propose that, you know, striking poses as a nostalgia trip, but certainly the imagery that is presented in that book is the imagery very much of my boyhood and young manhood in the Middle West. And one of the things that's to me is interesting about the book is that, you know, at that time it was sort of the existential wallpaper, right? I mean, every time you picked up any publication, you'd see a sort of silly picture of a movie star. And funnily enough, there were so many, there was such a plethora of them that it didn't really register, which is, of course, why the pictures are so outrageous. They were trying to get you to at least stop turning the page. I think that imagery, and there's some of it in the book, the imagery of people leading kind of glamorous lives. I mean, for example, one of the things people would do would, the movie studios would go to the star's home and photograph him or her in the home. And it looked beautiful. It looked wonderful. It looked enviable. And these people seemed so enviable. I mean, all the sort of cares airbrushed out of the picture along with the wrinkles. And I think these things, not any one of them, but the steady accretion of this kind of imagery at that time coming over the radio, there were always these kind of and Woody Allen in Radio Days did wonderful things with that. You know, the way the seemingly glittering world just would penetrate your home by the radio, or again by the kind of pictures that are in striking poses. I think it was. In a way, it was very potent, but in a way, it was also still a little more distant than the way they penetrate our consciousness via television nowadays.
Film critic Richard Schickel is my guest. We only have a couple of minutes left. I want to ask you a couple of things about current movies. Pauline Kael, in her latest book, wrote that people used to say, "Oh, you're so lucky! What a great job! You get to see all the new movies." But now people say to her, "Oh, poor you, you have to go see all these terrible movies. And a friend of mine is fond of saying that he goes to the movies not because he expects it to be good, but he's interested in the ways in which they're going to be bad. And I wonder if you agree with that kind of pessimistic view of recent films.
I would say for people Pauline's age or my age, and I'm somewhat younger than she is, or even people in their 40s or late 30s, it's hard to go to the movies now because the movies are so consciously aimed at the adolescent culture. So, you know, there's a kind of intrinsically distancing effect to these movies if you're older. I mean, it's not really easy to sit through, Project X or The Secret of My Success or that kind of a picture. I mean, movies were always for adolescents, you understand, but they hadn't deliberately cut themselves off from, you know, the older portion of the audience, and vice versa, the older portion of the audience hadn't cut themselves off. I do think that's going to change, by the way. I do think the video cassette is actually going to regroup in a funny way the old mass audience, so that I think more and more movies can be commercially successful with a broader appeal. They don't have to be quite so narrowly targeted to 14-year-olds or 16-year-olds. But, you know, on the other hand, we've gone through a bad patch, and the bad patch may continue for a while. But I'm seeing actually kind of fewer of this blatantly adolescent-oriented movies.
Well, very quickly, what are a couple of the films that are making you optimistic about the future of films?
Oh, there's a picture, Brian De Palma's new picture, The Untouchables, which I think is a wonderful and possibly even great American work. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm certainly looking forward to Stanley Kubrick's Full Metal Jacket because he's a great artist. I think there are a lot of potentially interesting movies over the next few months.
Richard Schickel, I regret we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
My guest has been Time Magazine film critic Richard Schickel, and he's written the text for a new book of promotional still photos of Hollywood stars of the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It's titled Striking Poses.